4 p.m., and we, while not absolutely critical for to have the quorum for our overview, we do have a quorum to conduct business. I call this meeting of the House Resources Committee to order on Friday, January 24th at 1:04. Present with us, Representative Kawasaki, Representative Olson, Representative Seaton, Co-Chair Feige, and myself, Co-Chair Sadler. We have no other legislators present with us that I see, and we have been joined immediately by Representative Pete Wilson. Let's see, please kill your cell phones, my advice to myself and to you. I want to acknowledge, which I did not do on Wednesday, that we do have Jess and Thatcher over here on the teleconferencing, and Julie with House Records is keeping us on record. Our purpose today is to have a brief overview of the activities and the operations of the Natural Resources Department and kind of update on who's who. And it's my intention actually to let the division directors and the commissioner and deputy commissioners go through their presentations in toto in the first hour. And I ask members to hold questions for the folks until after they've all finished. And so we can bring them back to the microphone afterwards. My experience is that many questions do get answered if we allow people to finish their presentations. If there are more questions than we have time for in the second part of the meeting, I would encourage members to meet with the department on a one-on-one basis, and any answers or data that develops, make sure and get back to me for distribution to the other members of the committee. And with that, I would like to invite our new commissioner to come forward, put himself on the record, and introduce his team to us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Joe Balash. I am the commissioner for the Department of Natural Resources. We're going to spend a little bit of time here today talking about the year that was. We spent, I think, a fair bit of time in the first session of this legislature going through the roles and responsibilities of our department. We are the primary land manager for the state's share of the acreage here in this great state. More than 100 million acres of uplands, an additional 60 million, I think, of submerged lands between tide lands, rivers, lakes, and such. So we have a big job, and it's one that I'm privileged to lead the effort on, but can't possibly do by myself. What we have here behind us and we'll bring to the table are the individual directors responsible for carrying out the functions of the department. With the resignation of Dan Sullivan, I was named commissioner in November. We had to backfill my spot with Bob Swenson, the former state geologist, and we've kept the assignments and the direct reports from the various offices and divisions relatively intact. Ed Fogles maintains oversight for Division of Ag, Division of Mining, Land, and Water, Division of Forestry, Division of Parks, Support Services, and the Office of Project Management Permitting. Bob, who was foolish enough to say yes, now oversees his former division, DGGS, the Division of Oil and Gas, the Mental Health Trust Land Office, the Gas Pipeline Project Office for the next couple of months, and the State Pipeline Coordinator's Office. Each of the directors for these offices is going to step forward and talk with you a little bit about their accomplishments over this past year. What is it we've done with the resources provided and within the authorities that we have? Hopefully, there will be something that strikes your fancy and we can investigate further as the 90 days are rolling on here. As for the commissioner's office specifically, I spent much of 2013 on issues that we're going to start talking about next week, so I won't bore you with a recitation of that or a preview of that. We'll have plenty of time. For the first office, the Gas Pipeline Project Office, Mr. Eric Hattelberg is the acting director, and he's unable to be here today. He's actually on a monitoring trip that went down to Houston earlier this week. We do continue to have monthly meetings with our AGEA licensee and their partners on the Alaska Pipeline Project. But as many of you know, we are going to be transitioning that office and function later this year. But over the course of 2013, Eric's shop maintained the regular oversight of project development plans, which is a precursor and an element that feeds into the reimbursement process under that particular statute. They engaged in a number of other activities, including hosting a presence at LNG 17, a triennial meeting that occurs globally and happened to be in Houston back in April. They contributed to the analysis that was done by Black & Veatch on our royalty study over the course of the summer and fall. They met with LNG buyers of various sorts and signed an MOU with REI, one of the parties that is interested in collecting a number of the buyers in Japan in a consortium.
Make sure, for the record, REI stands for Recreation Development.
I'm uncertain. Let's see. The bullet points say Resources Energy Inc. I'm struggling with that because it's actually a different set of words when they're talking about their business in Japan. So apologize for that. So that's a quick rundown on the gas pipeline project office. And from this point forward, we're going to try and as efficiently and hopefully quietly be able to rotate the different personnel here in order to be able to come up and speak to their specific divisions and describe their accomplishments for 2013. And I'll turn it over to Francie Habemeister.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Francie Habemeister. I'm the director for the Division of Agriculture. The division's mission is to promote and encourage an agriculture industry within the state, and we do that through our several components, one of which is the inspection section. In 2012 and 2013, we conducted pest surveys on diseases and pests of concern to agriculture, natural resources, and international trade. Surveys were conducted for Lepidoptera pests, which are large insects including moths and butterflies potentially affecting the timber industry, as well as study root nematodes and thrips. The absence or presence of a pest determines treatment that may or may not be necessary prior to exporting a product such as peony or timber. Inspections were conducted at the U.S.-Canada border in cooperation with Custom Border Patrol in an effort to evaluate pest pathways and or movements of product of concern. Items detained at the border resulted in seed potatoes and tomato plants as they lacked the required certification to enter the state. We performed timber and agriculture export certification on over $143 million of timber in fiscal year 13. This timber was bound for the export market to Korea, China, and Japan. The peony industry continues to expand within the state, and last year shipments were sent to Taiwan. The land section staff continues to identify land with soils suitable for agriculture production. Staff working in cooperation with Mining Land and Water increased agriculture land designations by 35,000 acres in Yukon-Tanana area plan. Discussions have continued with farmers and stakeholders regarding the agriculture land program. Six meetings were held this past year addressing topics such as clearing requirements, future sales, and agriculture covenants. The Plant Materials Center is a 407-acre production farm which produces foundation seed for grain and native grass growers, produces G0 seed potatoes for certified seed producers, houses the only certified seed lab within the state, and the only seed cleaning facility within the state. Variety trials were conducted on onions and asparagus. We have apple rootstock in variety trials currently, as well as potatoes. We're working with ADF&G and DEC on efforts to control the spread of Elodia. We've held public meetings in Anchorage and Homer to discuss treatment options, as well as working with both departments to establish guidelines on permitting requirements for treatment. The marketing section continues to explore innovative ways to market Alaska Grown. We've increased Alaska Grown farm membership, adding 75 new farm businesses to the program, which is a 13% increase over our 2012 numbers. The Alaska Grown Facebook page remains content-driven, continues to be an effective tool for outreach and education, and has over 15,000 likes and much traffic on a daily basis. Our restaurant reward program in 2013 had 21 participating restaurants, which increased their use of Alaska Grown by 44% over the previous year. Market's able to accept Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, also known as a SNAP program, in 2013 doubled from 5 to 10, bringing approximately an additional $30,000 to Alaska's farm markets. These markets are located with the ability to accept the SNAP programs in Sitka, Bethel, Fairbanks, South Central, and on the Kenai. Our farm-to-school program was selected to receive the Alaska Community Service Award for Health at the Alaska Health Summit Awards Luncheon scheduled for this January 29th, in recognition of an organization that is making a significant contribution to improving the health of Alaskans. We provided on-farm food safety workshops and had 50 producers in attendance. 76% of those attending indicated they would make changes to their farm practices as a result. 25 of 51 school food service directors completed our farm-to-school survey, and 100% of those participating in the survey agreed that there had been an increase in local food served in schools as a direct result of the farm-to-school program. With 80%, the farm-to-school program and projects have been successful throughout the state and recognized nationally, with 80% of Alaska's school districts actively engaged in the program, which is 47 out of 54 school districts. The following is a quote from Stacy Sobel, who is the Western Regional Lead for the National Farm to School Network. Alaska is recognized as a national leader in farm to school, producing models that have been shared with and emulated by other states across the country. The Alaska Food Resource Working Group was formed through Administrative Order 265, signed into law by the governor last June, which was the result of HCR 1. The objective of this order is to improve the health of state residents, increase food security, strengthen local economies, and encourage community development. This group has met twice, with the latest meeting held early January at the Plant Materials Center in Palmer, and which included invited testimony from vegetable producers from the Valley. This group will provide recommendations for policy changes that will increase the use of locally grown and harvested food, which will ultimately provide additional markets for Alaska producers. Thank you.
Thank you, Director.
Well, good afternoon, Mr. Co-Chairs and members of the committee. My name is Chris Mache, the Director of the Division of Forestry. I'm going to spend a few minutes with you to highlight our key accomplishments this past year in both our wildland fire and our forest management programs. I'd like to begin by reviewing our mission statement, which enumerates our core missions, which are as follows: serving Alaskans through forest management and wildland fire protection. And if you'd direct your attention to the slide for a minute, I want to explain the photos that are in the inset there. Those are wood pellets that are produced at the Superior Pellets LLC mill in North Pole, Alaska. They're being used in pellet stoves for both residential and commercial heating purposes up in interior Alaska. And they've also just recently added a log line, so they'll be doing compressed firewood, about 3-inch diameter pieces of wood that can be used in wood stoves that are also dried, which will help greatly with our air quality issues up there, especially in Fairbanks. But if you note the bags, I just wanted to point out the Made in Alaska logo on those bags. It's great to see that on a wood product like that, and it's a good success story. It's 100% state forest wood that goes into that facility, so it's something we're proud of.
Chris, excuse me, for the record, I want to recognize Representative Tarr has joined us.
Okay, great.
5 minutes ago, thank you.
Yep. So with that, I'll get into a few of the specifics for the forest management side. We are continuing to implement the recommendations in the governor's Alaska Timber Jobs Task Force report. We established a roads office within the Division of Forestry this past year by repurposing two PCMs for logging engineers, and then they're working on access development projects statewide. We're promoting a proposed Susitna State Forest Bill, which is HB 79 SB 28, which I'm hopeful you will hear more about as the session progresses. And we're using a $2 million capital improvement project to build access projects in southern southeast Alaska to access that state forest at Gravina Island and Edna Bay. We also, up in the interior, offered a 25-year long-term timber sale to support the combined heat and power project that was being proposed by Alaska Power and Telephone. It was 35,000 green tons a year. That sale unfortunately didn't sell, but it is now available on what we call over-the-counter so that someone can walk in and purchase that sale. And we actually are in negotiations, or at least discussions, with a company that has just recently expressed some interest. We also sold over 16 million feet of timber to various Alaska businesses, 37 of them this past year. And those businesses are located from southern southeast Alaska all the way up through interior Alaska. We also provided direct and indirect support to 105 woody biomass projects that are either under feasibility pre-feasibility construction or operation around Alaska. And again, you may be familiar with the AEA map that demonstrates where those projects are, but that's another very important aspect of the forest management program. And then we continue to work with the U.S. Forest Service to implement the 2008 Tongass Land Management Plan to support the timber industry in southeast Alaska. Moving on now, I'll talk a little bit about our wildland fire program. And I'd have to say that our most notable accomplishment this past year was successfully and safely responding to our fourth largest fire season over the past 10 years. 1.3 million acres were involved in wildland fires this year in the state, and we actually set a record number for the number of individual incidents, which is 613. That's the highest number it's actually ever been. It was also our second largest fire season if you look at the past 5 years. So a very busy year, but also very successful. We continue to build out and deploy our integrated fire management software tool, which is a dispatching tool, as well as a initial attack and overall fire management tool that we are developing and are deploying in all of our area offices statewide. In the aviation side of the program, we've completed procurement of an aerial turbine commander and are in the process of purchasing the second aircraft this month. We should actually close on that purchase. Those two planes replace the Pilatus PC-7s that used to be our lead air attack planes. These planes are used both in a lead plane role with the retardant ships that fly retardant in on a fire, as well as they provide overall air coordination on a fire between helicopters, retardant ships, and any jump ships that might be used on a particular incident. We also completed the training of 20 crew bosses in the Wildland Fire Crew Boss Academy. These folks came from 17 different communities around the state, almost all of them being rural communities, most of them being only air accessible. And a crew boss is needed to lead each 19-person Type 2 emergency firefighter crew that are located out in these communities. And the picture here are two of the crew bosses that just had completed their training. They're holding pictures there of the entire class. They're posed out in front of one of the Convair 580 air tankers that we contract for the Division of Forestry. And it's really a great picture. Every time I look at that picture, I smile just like they're doing. But the other aircraft, of course, in this picture in the background is the CL-215s, which are the water scoopers. And those are contracted by Alaska Fire Service, and we mix and match the use of those two aircraft platforms to match them to the incident and the type of fire. And if we have a close-by water resource, we use theirs. If we don't, we use the retardant ships. In addition to that, for this coming season, we have partnered with the University of Alaska to have them offer the Wildland Fire Academy, and they will be actually getting college credit to the students that take that academy, so it's a really good partnership between us and UAF. And we also, for the first time this year, did 14 internships with past academy graduates to integrate them into the program and really start building a pipeline of candidates for future openings in our division that we can draw from. So we're trying to build a recruitment pipeline in the fire organization. We also competed for wildland urban interface funding in the West, and we're very successful. We brought in over $1 million in hazard fuel mitigation projects in four different communities that are the Mat-Su, Fairbanks, Kenai, and Tok. And finally, we are completed the development of a project and a concept paper in collaboration with the Cold Climate Housing Research Center up in Fairbanks. It's for a new wildland fire center in the interior. And as you may know, Cold Climate is a leading entity when it comes to residential construction for energy efficiency, and we're trying to do the same now for commercial buildings. And so it's nice that we were able to collaborate with them in this initial concept paper. And with that, I'll end and turn it over to my colleague.
Thank you. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Steve Masterman. I am Acting Director of the Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys. And our mission is to determine the potential of Alaska land for production of minerals, fuels, geothermal resources, the location and supplies of groundwater and construction materials, and also the potential geologic hazards to buildings, roads, bridges, other infrastructure and communities. Our division is divided into six sections, so briefly I'll just go through some of the key accomplishments by section for last year. The minerals section, which is tasked with determining the potential of Alaska lands to host mineral occurrences. Spent a big part of the summer mapping and sampling a 2,600-square-mile area between Paxson and Talkeetna as part of the Strategic Critical Minerals Program. And we were looking for platinum group elements in that part of the state, and we'll be releasing the results of our work here fairly shortly. Under that same program, now we have collected and sampled and analyzed just about 10,000 rock samples and stream sediment samples, and are publishing those as we get them and making them available to industry. Another significant achievement for the mineral section was the either the acquisition or publishing of 4,500 square miles of airborne geophysical data, which is just an amazing accomplishment. Typically, we're somewhere less than 1,000 square miles a year, so this was a pretty remarkable year for us. And just for reference sake, that's almost the size of Connecticut, so we took a big bite last summer.
And a lot more minerals, too.
The Minerals Group also was active in the Alaska Range and mapped about a 200-square-mile area in the Styx River region, and the reason for that is the Styx River has some advanced-stage copper and gold properties, and we were out there trying to extend the known potential of the area. The energy section, which is responsible for determining the potential state lands for energy resources, was active again in the Cook Inlet and also on the North Slope. In the Cook Inlet, they mapped a 250-square-mile area on the west side of Cook Inlet, looking at the deeper Mesozoic rocks, which are the source rocks for the petroleum systems in the upper Cook Inlet. And so again, we'll be publishing that information, and the industry is pretty keenly interested in that. In part of that work, they discovered two new oil-stained exposures out there, which also generate quite a lot of interest.
And those are where?
The Styx River?
No, that's out in the West Cook Inlet. On the North Slope, the energy section is involved in a collaborative effort with the University of Alaska Fairbanks and also the USGS looking at oil shale occurrences up there and for the potential to host tight oil in the oil shales. And last but not least, the energy section completed a compilation of geothermal data around the state of Alaska, and this is quite an achievement. We've compiled all of the downhole geothermal data from oil and gas wells, geothermal wells, and all of the temperature and chemistry data for the surface information, and we'll be publishing that shortly online and in hard copy maps and reports as well. The Geological Materials Center, which is currently located in Eagle River, houses the state's collection of oil and gas and mineral samples from boreholes and also from surface exposures. And it's in the process of being relocated to a newly purchased building on Penland Parkway in Anchorage. We will be completing construction this summer and anticipate relocating the collection there in late summer, and we'll have a grand opening in September. So everybody's really excited about that. Industries, both mineral and oil and gas, are looking forward to the expanded access, and we're pretty excited about that ourselves. The engineering geology section works on geological hazards and groundwater issues and construction materials. And this year we initiated a hydrogeology program, and the main focus of the hydrogeology program is to assess groundwater systems and resources in areas of development, primarily oil and gas fields, and primarily the North Slope. Understanding the groundwater system there is going to be pretty critical going forward. We also worked with several other organizations on engineering geology studies. We worked with DOT on the Yukon River Bridge slide. We spent some time working on the various gas pipeline corridors and also on the Susitna-Wautana Dam. Another component of the engineering geology group is, from the hazard standpoint, is tsunami inundation mapping. And two communities we completed that for were Valdez and Sitka this year. And that information has also been published and presented to those communities, and they're generally very appreciative and excited to get that information. So, and last but not least, the engineering geology section was also working in western Alaska on coastal hazards, primarily erosion issues and flooding. Our volcanology section is part of the Alaska Volcano Observatory in conjunction with the University of Alaska and the USGS. And their primary role is to monitor and issue alerts when there are volcanic eruptions. And so that, right now, for your information, Veniaminoff and Cleveland volcanoes are at a stage of yellow alert. They're very low-level eruptions, but they are erupting. The volcanology section continued their work on some recently active volcanoes. We'll be continuing that this coming year. Finally, the Geologic Communication Center is really, in some ways, the glue that holds us all together and makes all this happen. They handle our network, computer network systems, and our website, and also publish all of our reports. And one of their key accomplishments this year was launching a completely new data set or publication type where we have the data live on our website. People can get into the data, interact with it, view the kinds of information they want to see, and then select what data they want to download. And we see this as an increasing part of our business. The online access to data is getting more and more common, and it's a cheaper way for us to get information out to the public. We're seeing our demand for paper reports and paper maps decreasing as we increase the availability of the information online. So, and along with that, we published 52 new geologic maps and reports, and we had over 6 million web page hits in the last year. And not on the slide here, we also have a Facebook presence and a Twitter feed. We have 12,000 followers on Twitter and over 40,000 likes on Facebook. So we're really trying to get our information out there in as many different ways as we can. So, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Marcy Menifee, and I'm the executive director of the Trustland Office. And I'll give a kind of a global overview of our accomplishments. And I just wanted to first say that, as most of you know, our mission is to manage the million acres of trust land in the state for the beneficiaries of the trust and for the trust itself. And it's kind of interesting to hear the numbers of acres of land the rest of DNR manages, because in comparison, ours is less than 1%. We're about a 16-member office, and our primary purpose and goal is to, of course, take the resources, the natural resources that have been given to the state under trust grants, and to create revenue streams for the beneficiaries. So, first looking at timber last year, we were able to successfully put out two small sales in Southeast, one in Wrangell and one on Prince of Wales Island, to generate just about 1 million acres of timber revenue. And related to timber, we're of course really at the end of the allowable or the available cuts of timber in the trust portfolio, and we've put a lot of emphasis and work into an exchange of timberlands with the Tongass National Forest in Southeast, about an 18,000 acre exchange, and we've spent the last probably 4 years in trying to really move this ahead, and just recently have got some commitments from Region 10 here, Forest Service, and their availability to actually work with us on an administrative exchange. So we're expecting to hopefully in the next 2 years finalize that exchange, and what that will do is give the trust a sustainable timber portfolio in Southeast for harvest, a perpetual harvest. Next, our land sale program, which is one of the hallmarks of our success, has sold less than 2% of the whole acreage, and yet has contributed over the years over $20 million in revenue. And we sell land across the state in three regions, competitively primarily, and then under some negotiated sales. And then next, looking at the trust coal and hard rock minerals, we've generated about $5 million in revenue in 2013. We have presently 350,000 acres of the trust million acres either under exploration license or lease for production, and are looking at this next year moving that to more like 450,000 acres, which is about half of the trust ownership for either coal or for mineral, hard rock mineral production. Our oil and gas program is new, and this year we put out a sale for some gas tracks and netted some, for us, high revenue. Over the 19 years that the land office has been in existence, this last sale was a banner year for the trust in oil and gas revenues in Cook Inlet. And then one of the newest and the most recent programs we put together is to purchase or to advance the trust commercial real estate. And it's a new program that the trustees fully support, because the type of money that comes in from leases for long-term rents of commercial land is money that the trustees can put into programs right away. And that program, which is just started, will probably, over the next 10 years, create a revenue stream of up to about $4 million of income for the trust. Over the last 19 years, the Trust Land Office has generated about $158 million in revenue, and we're looking at, of course, always trying to advance and improve that, and through a variety of the programs that I just mentioned, as well as new initiatives. We're working with, cooperatively working with the university and with the state forestry, to try to advance timber resources in Southeast, you know, in a more collaborative and in a better way for all the landowners. I think that's all I had.
Thank you, Christine. Could you just also, for the record, list who the beneficiaries of the trust are?
Sure. The beneficiaries of the trust are folks with developmental disabilities, Alaskans with Alzheimer's and related dementias, folks with alcoholic and substance abuse issues, and then finally the fourth is I'll get back to you on that.
Memory problems, there are
there's also folks represented with brain injuries.
Right, that's right.
That are represented by the beneficiary groups.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Moving along, you guys are hitting down great.
There you go. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Brent Goodarm. I'm the director of the Division of Mining, Land, and Water. And since I assumed this position about 2.5 years ago, the Division of Mining, Land, and Water has been engaged heavily on a comprehensive and multifaceted approach to eliminate a permit backlog and to work to further prevent its reoccurrence. Since we began the effort in fiscal year 2012, we have reduced that backlog by 53.5%, which is about 1,421 authorizations. Last year, we issued 497 authorizations during the year. That's the most, looking back, that we've done in a long, long time. That does not include another 724 APMA permits that our mining section issues as well last year. And so there's a lot of authorizations that our division does statewide. A critical component, yes, sir.
I'm sorry, APMA for the record, just
yeah, it's applications for permits to mine in Alaska. It was renamed. It's always been APMA. People in the mining industry have always called it that. But it was renamed to that particular wording, I guess. So, thank you. A critical component of us continuing to work addressing, improving our permitting efficiency is to modernize it, and we've been doing that through the Unified Permit Project. Last year, we rolled out land use permits in an automated fashion. Next month, we will be able to roll out our release one of our water rights element of that, as we also continue to improve our land use process. A number of large statewide projects that members of our division are engaged in are the Port McKenzie Rail Extension, a number of Roads to Resources projects, North Slope Oil and Gas Exploration, ADA's LNG Trucking. In fact, just the decision, preliminary finding decision went out on Friday, last Friday, with regards to that project, as well as the City and Borough of Juneau cruise ship dock decision that went out recently as well. On the North Slope, this year we've issued, there's over 377 miles of ice and road network this year that our folks help inspect and oversee, and so it's quite busy. That's the most number of miles of that type of roadage that we've had up there. This past year we also successfully amended the 2005 Bristol Bay Area Plan with significant public participation and input. We received over 500 public comments, and through that process increased the wildlife habitat in that area, or at least the classification of it, by over 2.6 million acres, and the public recreation area by over 1.1 million acres. And so a lot of hard work went into that process. Lastly, about a year ago at this time, we worked closely with DEC and the Coast Guard to help remove a couple submerged vessels in Jackaloff Bay. That were of great concern to the mariculture farms there. We continue to work that issue, but stewardship is something that's very important to our division as well. And one other thing that I failed to mention, in September of last year, we worked closely with BLM and came into a cooperative agreement with them to help resolve longstanding native allotment issues. We've helped create a program that's voluntary for those that have been waiting for quite some time, in some cases close to 4 years, for resolution of their application process in fulfillment of those longstanding federal promises for those lands. And with that, I will turn it over to Bill.
Thank you, Brent.
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Bill Barron, the Director of Oil and Gas for the State of Alaska. Where the group that I'm responsible for is responsible for leasing and land management associated with oil and gas and geothermal activities on state land. I won't read through all of my bullets. It's a couple of pages in length. I ask each one of my section leads to kind of put what they were most proud of, so I'll let the committee at their discretion read some of those. But just as a couple of highlights, in the leasing section, we had 90 leases awarded in the recent North Slope sale. What's critical about that is not necessarily the number, but it's that all of them were executed and issued within 7 weeks after the sale. In years past, that has taken us upwards of 8 to 12 months. The leasing section has gone through a very interesting profile practice of researching what they do, why they do it, and how they do it, and this is a very much an efficiency increase for that organization. To the body of this chair, thank you very much for executing the lease extension bill that was propagated through this body last year. We didn't waste any time in its action. Six applications were received, five two-year extensions were granted, and one was rejected. So an immediate result of actions by this body, and we greatly appreciate that new tool. In the resource evaluation section, something that is of very great interest and intrigue is the work that the team has been doing with the USGS and the Department of Energy on North Slope methane hydrates. We carved out some acreage that would be used for hydrate research up on the North Slope in combination with DOE and the USGS in those efforts. So that's kind of an interesting project that will be really kind of a real first for not only the state but for the nation. In the commercial section, one thing that has been on several of our minds for quite a while is trying to understand the financial wherewithal of some companies, whether they're big or small, but how does that impact their ability to cover the requirements for dismantlement, removal, and restoration of facilities offshore Cook Inlet or onshore activities as well. And the commercial team pulled together a very nice piece of work that that looks at the financial wherewithal of companies and kind of gives us a bit of a roadmap on how we can look at bonding or other financial means of securing funds required for that removal. And if you do have some time, it is out on our website. It's a very interesting piece of work done by some very creative minds. Lastly, the Petroleum Integrity Office, PSIO, worked very, very closely with the State Pipeline Coordinator's Office, and I don't know if Director Allison Iverson will talk about it, but if she doesn't, I will. So, here this year, Alyeska had a bit of a problem with some debris in their line, and the PSIO, through their intellectual prowess and their contacts, were able to lean in and help help a sister agency in becoming a technical repository to give them some guidance and help on some of their pipeline projects. Please do read through the rest of those articles, but those are the big highlights of things that are new and creative coming out of the division. And with that, I will give you to Parks.
Thank you, Bill. Hey, Ben.
Mr. Co-Chairs, committee members, for the record, my name is Ben Ellis. I'm the Director of Parks and Outdoor Recreation. I believe this week your office should have received a letter from me with some attachments. It's our fourth year providing a semi-annual report to you on the status of parks and recreation, primarily in your area. As you remember, in the springtime, we send you material about what we will be doing in your area during the summer, both on the operational side and also on our welcome to deferred maintenance and capital improvement projects. And then we, at this time of the year, like to report back what we're able to do and give you some before and after pictures. Many of you have shared that in your newsletters. It's been very helpful to get that information out to your constituents. I appreciate that. It's been a great collaborative partnership, and I look forward to continuing. I'm going to hit just very briefly the six sections that we have. Most of the detail will in your area or statewide will be in the material that's been provided to you. I will be back, as I normally come back, a week in the first part of February. I'm in the process of my staff working with yours to set up a 10 to 15 minute meeting with either you or one of your staff members. I look forward to hearing your perception or your comments on state parks, and especially your constituents' comments on Alaska state parks. It's been very, very helpful as we have moved forward in a number of areas. So let me just very briefly talk to you about our various sections. The largest and probably the most prominent, when people think of Alaska state parks, they think of parks and outdoor recreation management. We have 82 permanent full-time staffers with 23 non-perm staffers. We have over 800 volunteers that we could not do the management and service that we provide the public without that type of collaboration. We have approximately 3.1 million acres in Alaska State Parks, the largest state park in the nation. We have the largest state park unit, Wood-Tikchik, at 1.6 million acres, and the third largest, the Chugach State Park, at right at a half million acres, 500,000 acres. Throughout that, we have 124 park units, 71 campgrounds. I mean, I could go on and on. There's a lot of material and infrastructure that has been put in place. And we collaboratively work with ADF&G and other state agencies to address those. And we've got 900 miles of trail that have been developed. And that is a large part to the Alaska Trails Office. It has two full-time staff members, and we have two part-time staff members. The Trails Office is primarily, at this time, supported by federal funds. Some of that federal money has been run its course. The Alaska Trails Initiative that Senator Stevens championed, and we're in the last go-around of grants. And so the administrative cost that has been able to be pulled from that section is not going to be available for us in the future. And I think If you have noticed in the governor's budget, there is suggested funding so that we can continue this very critical program. Trails Office acts as a clearinghouse for $1.6 million of federal money that is able to go out in communities. Half of it goes to communities and to people like Trail Mix and other local trail organizations, and half of it stays within the state parks to work on state park trails for all of our folks to use. Also under this program is the Snow Track program, which is a snow machine registration fee that is administered by the Division of Motor Vehicle. We receive, it's a $5 fee, we receive about $220,000 to $250,000 a year to provide grooming, safety, etc. That area has mushroomed, and the demand far outstrips our ability, but we continue to work with the snow machine organizations to provide the services that we can in the areas that are most crucial. We do, for the third year, we've participated in a first day hike, and it's a nationwide program through state parks where on January 1st, folks get out and take a hike or do a bike trip or do a cross-country ski. We had some like 50 people, I believe, up in the Tok area doing a walk during that time this summer. We've had folks at Hatcher Pass, so it's been a fun program. And then we have a Trails Day program celebration that happens in the summertime. One area that a lot of folks don't realize that is in the Department of Parks and Outdoor Recreation is the Office of History and Archaeology, and they've got 12 archaeologists and 7 historians. Judy Bittner leads this section. And I guess probably the most important or impressive thing is that they have around 260,000 projects they review each year. A lot of review. And this mainly is working with the Corps of Engineers and other, almost in a coordinating fashion, to make sure that the history and archaeology of the state is protected, but at the same time that either resource development or whatever the movement is, transportation improvements can happen in a coordinated effort. And I believe they do a very good job of that. Our design and construction section is probably one of the most unique areas because of the 15 or 16 employees that we have in that section. It's only about 2 on general funds. It is an enterprise organization. In other words, of the people that work there, they are paid on projects that not only State Parks is doing through deferred maintenance or capital improvement, but they work with the Trust Land Office. They work with abandoned mine lands. They work with DOT. They work with mining land. I've got a list of the agencies I work with. It's very impressive. So that they are other than DOT, we're sort of the, and even for some of DOT's smaller projects, we're the design and construction staff that work on a lot of the state projects, state and federal projects. It's a very, very impressive group that is over in that section. I'm proud of all the sections, but the Office of Boating Safety is probably one of the most outstanding programs nationwide. Jeff Johnson has done an outstanding job, and I get a little emotional because it has saved a number of children's lives, and we're very, very proud of it. Another area that we're very proud of, wrong way. Take the thank you.
This is
your right
here.
Yeah, that's it.
No, one more.
Going the wrong way?
Yeah. Okay, here we go. Another thing I'm very proud about. For the first time in 30 years, we've started a new campground project. And it's, it's every bit of it your responsibility, and you should take full responsibility and thanks and praise for it. The South Denali Visitor Center complex we had a groundbreaking this past year. This thing is a $47 million project. It's not a small project. It's one of the, it's definitely the largest thing that State Parks has ever been involved in. Through your guidance, we have appropriated, you've appropriated about half of that money, around $22 million, starting back way back in 09. Instead of sitting there and waiting for the whole thing to be funded, we decided, you know, we need to provide recreational opportunity for Alaskans with what we've got, and we're moving forward to that with a campground and with a road that would get into the campground so that we can begin the recreational opportunities as we're working on phase two. And so if you look there, we broke ground this summer. We've got, you know, the access road. The picture that you see there is the part of the 2.3-mile access road up to the campground area. We've got, in less than a month, we had over like 35 inches of rain up in that section. I believe it was in August. But even with the sloshy conditions, the contractor was able to come through on time and get complete the work there. So the road's in. The campground's been brushed out. We'll be going in next year with the finishing the campground. We're hopeful that maybe we can get a shakedown of the campground in maybe August or September, but it's along the Parks Highway, and it's always, the weather's always challenging up there. So if we get a good spring, summer, and fall, I think we'll have a shakedown of the campground. Otherwise, it will be coming online the following summer. And you'll notice that in the governor's budget, there's a couple of part-time positions that would come on to help this area. This is one of the, it's not only a visitor center, but we see this, and it's been through studies with the university, could be a very significant profit center for state parks. And as we look at what, how we move toward the future structure a park system that will be sustainable, this, I think, facility and the foresightedness that you have be critical. So with that, I thank you very much.
Thank you, Director Ellis. That's good to hear.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Tom Crawford. I'm the director of DNR's Office of Project Management and Permitting, or OPMP, as we commonly refer to it. OPMP, you'll notice that the bullets on here, many of the bullets on here mention coordination, and because that is, to a large degree, what OPMP does. OPMP doesn't have any regulatory authority with which to grant permits. We don't issue any kinds of authorizations, but we work with project applicants and the state agencies to coordinate the permitting process for a variety of different kinds of projects, and then as well as tracking and being involved with the state's response to a wide range of federal initiatives, projects, plans, and most of these activities for private sector projects, as well as for any kind of state sector projects, are funded through agreements with the project applicants. In the case of private sector applicants, those are memoranda of understanding, and if it's a state applicant like ADA, then through a reimbursable services agreement. And so here are key accomplishments for 2013. We have signed a number of new memoranda of understanding with project applicants on the oil and gas side, Buccaneer, and this is for a variety of different projects that Buccaneer is working on in the Cook Inlet area, as well as the Buccaneer's Cosmo property, which is the offshore gas occurrence that's near Deep Creek, just off of the shore out in Cook Inlet. Link, we've been working with Link on their Umiat project that's just on the edge of NPRA, and working just recently this past year with NORDAC on their Tulamonic exploration project in NPRA. Similarly, also with ConocoPhillips on the Greater Moose's Tooth project with that they're trying to bring on stream, and it's in the midst of a federal EIS. On the mining side, there are two new MOUs that we signed this year, one with company Graphite One that has a graphite property up on the Seward Peninsula that, by all accounts, has some a real prospect for becoming developed. And then also a property by a company called Free Gold. This is their Golden Summit property. This is in the Cleary Summit area in Fairbanks, very close to the Fort Knox gold mine. That's in the very, very early stages, and just begun the process of dialoguing with them about kinds of environmental studies that they might need. Moving on here to with we've have been working with Apache on their Cook Inlet seismic survey program. There's Apache acquired a lot of leases in Cook Inlet, some of which are within the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge. This is for lands that held largely by Siri Native Corporation within the Kenai Refuge. And it's been a complex process of negotiating the permitting the maze, if you will, of authorizing those exploration activities within the refuge. OPUMP was very much involved with coordinating state agency involvement and input to the Eisenbeck Land Exchange. Unfortunately, that turned out to be an unsuccessful effort with Secretary Jewell's December 23rd denial of that the land exchange. I think we've probably not heard the last, however, about that road. OPUMP worked with state agencies to coordinate the state's review and input and comment on EPA's Bristol Bay assessment document, and that the final version of that document, I think most folks are probably aware, was just issued on January 14. For the Red Dog Mine, this was actually the first year that Red Dog had an environmental audit. Now, these environmental audits are something that we regularly require for mining projects. In Red Dog's case, because it was permitted and began operations a long time ago, and it kind of began before some of the state's current authorizations and regs were in place, and so this wound up being the very first environmental audit for Red Dog, despite the fact that it's been in operation since 1989. Similarly, move on to Pogo. At Pogo, they've had some great exploration successes in recent years, and they've discovered some substantial additions to their ore reserves, one of which is this East Deep project that we were very much involved with the coordinating the permitting of its development, as well as this expansion of their tailings dry stack disposal facility. For the Greens Creek mine, Greens Creek went through the permitting process in EIS for the expansion of its dry stack tailings facility, and permits have not yet been issued, but that EIS was completed, and state agencies are working on the issuance of permits. And then we have been involved for several years now, and will continue to be so, coordinating state agency participation in the EIS process for the Donlin Creek gold property, which is on Crooked Creek, near Crooked Creek on the Kuskokwim River. And so that's just a kind of a quick summary of things that we've been involved with this past year.
Thank you, Mr. Crawford. Appreciate it. Ms. Iverson.
Hello. For the record, my name is Allison Iverson, and I'm the Acting State Pipeline Coordinator. The State Pipeline Coordinator's Office issues leases for state land for pipeline rights-of-way and implements the state's policy set forth in Alaska Statute 3835 concerning the development, use, and control of pipeline transportation systems within the state. We have several key accomplishments. Our office has been very busy in recent years. To run through them really quickly, at the start, we facilitated the Badami Pipeline's transfer of interest from BP Transportation Alaska to Newtok Pipeline, which is a conglomerate of Savant Alaska and an ASRC subsidiary. The second bullet there, we released the 2013 annual report. We modified the report to make it a bit more user-friendly, and if you haven't seen it, I really encourage you to go and look at it. It is a compilation of DNR activities as well as other state agencies within the State Pipeline Coordinator's Office. And it also lays out the lessee annual reports in summary fashion. I think it's really critical to review the compliance and other permitting efforts associated with these important pipelines. Our office facilitated the LCTOC change of service from natural gas liquids to natural gas. We've been working very hard on an amended application for the Transforland Pipeline Company. This is a 28-mile pipeline that will run under Cook Inlet from the Custatan facilities to the Kenai Tank Farm. We anticipate releasing a preliminary decision on that application in the near future. We also have worked on several different applications and projects on the North Slope facilitating a trucking, LNG trucking operation to bring gas to Fairbanks. One of those projects is the Spectrum LNG. We did issue a lease to Spectrum. It's an 8-inch pipeline. We also have completed the commissioner's analysis and proposed decision for the Polar project, which is another LNG project up on the North Slope. Our office regularly issues CAPS amendments to allow them to complete system upgrades, improvements, and necessary maintenance activities. Last year was a banner year. We had 5 CAPS amendments and a lot of field activity, which is really nice. On the TAPS note, it's not on one of our bullets, but we have worked very closely with a recent coupon failure, as Director Barron noted. I think the incident was an excellent example of the Joint Pipeline Office and utilizing state and federal areas of expertise. The agencies in this root cause analysis and continuing efforts in monitoring Alaska's response continue to speak in one voice, which I can assure you is no simple task, but it is really critical to making sure that Alaska knows where the agencies stand, what they're asking for, and they're not receiving conflicting or multiple messages. And so I think it's been a success story, definitely, in that sense of back on the bullets, we continue to coordinate state permitting and right-of-way efforts for the Alaska Standalone Pipeline and for the AKLNG Pipeline. And in this effort, DNR, our office, is issuing permits, but we're also coordinating multiple permits with other agencies, particularly DOT, Fish and Game, and the Office of History and Archaeology. And a lot of these permits cover vast activities. For instance, one permit from our office may cover up to 200 borehole locations. So these permits are complicated, and we do anticipate that they will be continuing as those projects move forward. And last bullet on the list, we've been in the field a lot with the Point Thompson project. Last year, they installed approximately 2,200 vertical and horizontal support members, and we will be in the field again this winter as they complete construction of the export pipeline. That is all from our office.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. For the record, my name is Jean Davis. I am the director for the Division of Support Services, and if you hadn't noticed, we went alphabetically. And alphabetically, I'm last, which, okay, except for Commissioner Balash, almost allows me to back clean up. Support services really supports everything that my colleagues just talked about. Everything they talked about is what DNR is all about. Support services it is basically the administrative support arm for about 1,000 employees in DNR spread across 32 locations statewide. We do our typical administrative services support. We have the IT infrastructure for everything from managing our land records, mapping, business process automation, the network and servers, desktop support. We have accounting and financial support, paying all the invoices, recording all of DNR's revenue. Last year we recorded about $2.6 billion in revenue into the state accounting system. federal grant accounting, supporting all of the federal grants that come into the department. Budget preparation, we have a section that assists all of the divisions in preparing budgets and bringing them to the legislature, working through the process, the appropriation process. And then once we have got the appropriations, we're working on implementing everything and then helping divisions monitor their budgets and us and making sure that we come out clean in the end. We have procurement and facility support, so we're supporting all of the purchases of goods and services, everything from simple equipment purchases to something pretty complex related to aviation contracts for firefighting or field camps for a lot of the different the logistics for the field groups that go out to complex economic development and contract analysis. And we have human resources where we're supporting all of the department's recruitment and hiring, as well as all the management services. And then in addition to that, the Support Services Division has the state recorder's offices, which provide the permanent record for recording things such as your mortgage and your deeds and your liens on real property. And looking at just some of the key accomplishments that we've done here, in the recording office, we have implemented in 2013 e-recording, electronic recording, in 91% of our districts, which was 31 of 34. And that basically allows all of our customers to be able to file their business documents with the recorder's office electronically, which means they don't always have to come to an office in the district to do that. It really has helped us, especially in our single-staffed offices, when somebody would like to have a vacation or when they are unexpectedly sick. We can continue the recording process in a timely manner. So next year for my 2014 report, I'll be able to say that we did bring on the last three districts, and that was just last week. So we are now the fourth state to fully implement electronic recording statewide. Our IT shop has been instrumental in providing programming support for the unified permit automation. Brent Goodrum from Mining Land Water mentioned the automation of the land use permits and the water rights. We've been heavily involved in providing that programming support there, as well as the software and infrastructure for that. And our financial services and accounting and procurement folks are heavily involved with the Department of Administration's project that you may hear referred to as IRIS. It's a large capital project that they're leading that you all appropriated a few years ago base money for. It's a replacement for all of the state's accounting. Payroll, HR, and we're adding, bringing on procurement. And we've been very invested in that effort for them. And that would cover support services.
Thank you, Jean.
Mr. Chairman, I know at times we talk about the spectacular wealth that we have here in our resources. And it's true, we have world-class resources here in Alaska. The men and women behind me provide world-class management. Their leadership is outstanding, and I think every Alaskan should be quite proud to have them taking care of our resources for today and tomorrow. So be happy to answer any questions. I'll try to quarterback maybe if there are things that anybody wants to go back to. I appreciate the ability to work steadily through, but I thought it was very good to get each individual up here so that you could start to associate names and faces and know who it is you can call on as we help you do your job over the next 84 days.
That's all there is. Now, you have, obviously, Commissioner, you have a very busy department. Thank you. I appreciate the committee members' indulgences for letting us run through the whole line there. I think what it might be a good thing to do structurally is to bring people up again in the same order in which they originally presented, just to see those questions, because I know that my questions have been accumulating on an alphabetical basis as well. So with that, I'm not sure if I'm bringing Director Habermeister back up for agriculture.
Sure.
Oh, well, I guess B comes first, and he's the commissioner, so I'll just stand by Francine, and we'll see if there's questions for the commissioner, because I suspect there might be. Representative Feige.
I want to move aside from the shrapnel and all that. Lateral damage. Under the let's see, under Eric Cattleberg's responsibilities, the first slide, number three. Said you'd sign an MOU with Resources Energy Inc., REI, to focus effort on the Cook Inlet LNG export project. Could you kind of go into a little more detail on that, because that conflicts with information that I received somewhere else?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Co-Chair, REI came onto the scene in Alaska more than a year ago and initially expressed interest in participating in Norse commercialization of Norse Slope gas as LNG. There was an initial MOU signed with REI by the previous director, Kurt Gibson, to coordinate with them, provide information, and help them understand what the opportunities are and aren't with regard to North Slope gas. In the fourth quarter here of 2013, it became clear that the timeline REI was seeking to achieve would not match up with the opportunity presented by the AK LNG project. They are quite focused on the year 2019. And rather than try to shoehorn things with the additional interest in exploration and potential opportunity to grow the market for gas in the Cook Inlet Basin, REI and the Gas Pipeline Project Office turned their focus to opportunities in Cook Inlet as opposed to the North Slope. Now, what does that mean? It means they're going to need to look at a much smaller initial configuration and output of LNG product.
Okay, fair enough. Thank you.
Other questions for the Commissioner? All right, get off easy. Okay, Director Hevemeister of Agriculture. Any questions? Representative Seaton.
Thank you. I appreciate the job that agriculture has been doing. However, we received a legislative audit in 2013 looking at the revolving loan fund, and the suggestion in that audit was that the expertise of the Department of Commerce might be much more in line with granting loans, successful loans, than the Department of Agriculture. And I'm wondering, can you fill us in on where the department is as far as looking at that portion of the audit, and whether they're opposing that or they're in alignment with that loan granting function taken to commerce?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Seaton, we did take a look at the audit, and although I believe it is on record that we don't agree with everything that came out of the audit, there was some good information that we are looking into incorporating within the ARLF loan program. It is always good to review your procedures, your processes, and we are taking an internal look on that. We believe that the Board of Ag has done a good job in administering that program, but we are always open to suggestions to improve that.
Follow up, please.
I just want to follow up because it was looking at the history of the loans that were granted, the expertise on financial expertise to approve loans, which seemed to be much more aligned with the Department of Commerce, which does those things on a continuous basis. I mean, that seems to be there. So is the department saying that they believe that the expertise should remain with people that are familiar with agriculture but they're not familiar with as familiar with granting of institutional loans? How are you trying to accommodate the deficiency that was identified by the legislative?
So Through the chair, Representative Seaton. I believe one thing that was addressed in that audit was the need to review regulations that are currently in place. They did talk specifically about that. We do have a loan officer on staff that reviews those, and we have a Board of Agriculture that does follow regulations in approving those loans. I believe that DNR's response letter was, although they believe that there was room for improvement within the ARLF loan program, they did feel that the Board of Ag and the ARLF was continuing to revolve successfully. So as far as ongoing discussions, I know that Representative Feige has introduced House Bill 207, in which we are in conversations with, which would remove the loan authority to Commerce, but the ARLF loan functions would still remain, and the management would still remain with the board, as well as the board's ability to write the regulations, but the final loan approval would go to Commerce, if that answers your question.
Okay. Thank you. And Mr. Chairman, thank you. I haven't followed the bill, so I presume we'll have this discussion in more detail when the bill comes up. So thank you.
Okay. Representative Olson and Tarr.
Director, have you taken a position on the Speaker's cattle branding bill?
Through the chair, Representative Olson. Currently, the Division of Ag also has authority over brands, and we do issue the brand program. So my understanding is that there was authority within revenue and authority within Division of Ag. We currently administer the brand program, so unless they remove the authority within the Division of Ag, my understanding is that that authority would remain.
I think a few of us have been working our way through that bill, and we're still a bit confused.
Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of quick questions. Was excited to hear about how successful the farm-to-school program is, and having not had an opportunity to look at the budget in great detail, if you could compare what's in the proposal so far this year for that versus what happened last year, because I know at some point it was unclear whether there would be funding to continue the program. So that's my first question. So I'll let you go to that one first.
Okay. Through the chair, Representative Tarr. Yes, there is funding to continue the farm-to-school program in the governor's budget this year. Mm-hmm. Last year, due to a fiscal error that somehow was missed, the program was in statute for 4 years but only had a fiscal note for three. So last year was just the continuation of just a one-year fiscal note to meet the sunset date. But there is a budget increment, I believe, for $181,000 to continue the program into the baseline budget.
Thank you.
To be fair, let's go for new topic. Feige?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. During last year's legislative session, there was a reappropriation of funds from the university to PMC, specifically for seed potatoes, improvements in the seed potato program. Could you kind of inform us as what you have done with that funding? I know you had a major retirement within that that particular group. Just like to hear how you're spending the money.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Feige. Yes, we just completed that budget request through DNR for their approval. We plan to use part of that money to buy testing to be utilized at the PMC for disease testing on potato products. We're planning on setting up a potato symposium, bringing up experts from the lower 48 to address disease issues as well as certification. We're planning on partnering with the University of Fairbanks, actually University of Alaska Trunk Road facility, to do some variety tests and disease testing out there, and as well as train another inspector in potato disease inspections, as our current inspector, Bill Campbell, is set to retire sometime late spring.
Okay. So, Tara, do you have a different question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have a question, and it's related to the dairy issues that have been ongoing in the MATSU, and if you could give a brief update as it, helps us reflect on my colleague's questions here about the loan fund and
sure.
Better management.
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, in 2007, just a little history for those of you who don't know, in 2007, an ARLF asset, Matt Made, was closed by the Board of Ag, which was the only processing facility within the state of Alaska. At that time, another dairy received, I believe it was somewhere around, I don't remember exactly, I think it was $600,000 in federal funds. to continue the program. They came into the loan fund requesting additional funds to create their own dairy or their own creamery to process local milk. The Board of Ag made very difficult decisions with the direction from the then Governor Palin to assist the dairy industry, approving loans to assist that dairy. That dairy, it was very public, closed in, I think it's been a little over a year, maybe a year ago in December. The board called the loans on that, which equaled somewhere right around $800,000. So there was a loss to the ARLF. Mm. Assets were sold, but as you can imagine, there is not a big demand for creamery equipment within the state of Alaska. Mm-hmm. So assets are, so there was a loss to the ARLF. Okay. Though I will say that it does continue to revolve. I think we ended up with a $500,000 loss in that year with the write-offs, but typically we have somewhere around a $400,000 or $500,000 gain with interest annually.
Thank you. Thank you. We have lots of divisions behind you, so I want to say thank you. And thanks to Sony and the folks at PMC. We toured the facility, the farm tour this summer, and enjoyed it very much.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
Questions for the Division of Forestry and Chris Mache? Representative Seaton.
Thank you. One of the things I know that on the Kenai watershed, there were a number of old forestry roads that had culverts that were no longer allowing fish passage. And I know that the borough has been trying to go through and clean some of those up. But one problem that was identified was old forestry roads that were transferred to native corporations were no longer being assessed, as even though the culverts were put in under forestry roads, they were not even assessed as to what the condition was. Is there anything that the Division of Forestry is looking at on old forestry roads and the culverts that are blocking anadromous fish passage?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Seaton, I think that conversation probably started at the Board of Forestry meeting we had on the Kenai about a year ago. And for roads that were initially done and met forestry standards that were then converted to other uses, they then do not fall with under the State Forest Practices Act. So that's not directly under the purview of the Division of Forestry at that point to continue to monitor those road systems. You also may recall that we have a road condition survey that is going back, effort to take a look at old forest roads, especially roads that were in place prior to the State's Forest Practices Act. So you'd call some of these our legacy culverts, for lack of a better word. And a red pipe is the way we describe a culvert gets a color code based on whether it can pass fish, is a problem to pass fish, or anadromous fish, or cannot pass anadromous fish. And that's what a red pipe is cataloged as. So we're working our way through any state-owned road systems that have red pipes, as well as DOT doing the same thing, to replace those as funds are available to do that. The legacy road systems are more of an issue, especially if they're on private lands, because they were not required to meet those standards at the time those roads were put in. So that's more of a carrot approach. There's not a regulatory approach at this time to address some of those legacy roads.
And to follow up on that,
brief follow-up,
is there anyone else in DNR that, since forestry doesn't have that those roads anymore, is there anyone else that is has responsibility for looking at those? I mean, we've got most of those are in the Mat-Su, and we have a lot of problems with habitat issues in the Mat-Su and anadromous fish. And I'm wondering whether there's where can you lead us to where the follow-up would be within the state system to take care of those?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Seaton. That's a little bit of a complicated answer. It depends on who the land manager or land owner of that road system is. Of course, some of those road systems were acquired by the boroughs when they had their borough selections. So that responsibility then would lie with the borough to be in compliance with any fish passage requirements, which are actually administered via the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. So DNR itself does not manage roads other than the Division of Forestry. And we're the only division that really has that authority and responsibility under both Forest Practices Act for private and municipal and state lands if it's a forestry operation. So otherwise, you have to go back to who the land owner is and actually who owns the road for management purposes.
The rest of the public road system would fall with DOT, and they would have to be working with ADF&G to coordinate responses for culverts that do not pass fish. And to my knowledge, I'm not an expert on that. I know they are often in conversation about that topic. It benefits no one to have culverts in place that do not pass fish. So I don't know if that's completely answered your question, and I'd be happy to follow up more with you later.
Appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Feige?
Hey, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Director, just, you know, sort of an attaboy for a lot of the work that you guys have been doing, and especially in the forestry and forest products sectors. There's been a lot of sort of entrepreneurial spirit demonstrated there, and trying to really help that industry get going, and be it with permitting reform or HB 79, some of the aspects of that bill. Really good to see us developing sort of our own resources for our own use. On the air tankers that the state uses, you mentioned it's the Alaska Fire Service, which is basically BLM, correct?
It hires
those air tankers. And I know the transition from the Pilatus PC-7s to the turbine commanders, mm-hmm. Obviously a very great improvement in the state's ability to coordinate the use of tankers and coordinate air assets over a fire. With the aircraft, like on the slide here, you got a CL-215 water scooper there on the slide. Has the division looked at acquiring, maybe not necessarily a 215 or a 415, which is the turbine powered version of that, but in some of the smaller air tractor makes an AT-802, that kind of a single engine, you know, amphibious, kind of a big floatplane with an engine and a tank. Would there be utility for something like that? Because it can be used on relatively small fires, quick response, and just about anywhere in the state.
Mm-hmm.
And would it allow us to save, improve our firefighting ability in the wildlands? Because you could send that airplane to a small fire instead of having to send a crew with its associated logistical trail to fight fires. Has the state looked at that? Would you be able to, even in a low, say a low fire year, we didn't have a lot of work for it, you can certainly shop that around the Western United States and generate revenue with it in terms of all the other interagency agreements out there.
Yeah, through the chair, Mr. Co-Chair, you pretty much answered your question right there with your end comment, because that's how we acquire those assets right now, are from other states when we need those. So we're a member of the Northwest Compact, which includes primarily the northern tier states, the western states, and several Canadian provinces. And so this year, for example, which was a very busy year, we had at one time 8 different, most of them were the 415 versions in-state that we ordered through the Northwest Compact. We can order direct with the Canadians. There's 2 of those available from Alberta, 2 in Saskatchewan. They usually come in modules of 2. And so we can bring on and then use and then get rid of that asset when we don't need it. So we found that to be the most cost-effective way to do it. And we haven't had any issues with getting them when we've needed them and then releasing them when we no longer have a need. The single engine air tanker, we just call shorthand, is a SEAT, and those usually come in modules of 3. And we have used those here in Alaska. They are very effective for initial attack. Any aircraft doesn't negate the need to put a crew on the ground, because even though they can knock down the fire and do some serious damage to it, we still got to usually dig it out and make sure it's actually really out. So it's not a substitute for putting a crew there, but it certainly can help to do aggressive initial attack and keep that fire small. And again, we can get those resources also through resource ordering from the lower 48. And then, as you alluded, our retardant tankers have been going to the lower 48. As you may know, the U.S. Forest Service has a severe shortage of air tankers nationally, and we've actually been providing 3 air tankers on our contract to the lower 48
as part of the national firefighting effort. And as soon as ours are done here for the year and we can start safely releasing them, they go south in addition. And those are a bit of a, we don't try and make a profit, if you will, on that. We certainly cover our administrative expenses and some indirect charges. That works both ways. They do that to us if we do it to them. So if you're trying to charge them for daily availability and all the other kind of things that you might be able to charge, in the end, it just works out to share the resource and take reasonable expenses and leave it at that, if you would. So hope that answers your question.
Okay, so follow up. Basically, you believe that the current arrangement offers the most efficient use of funds to take care of wildland fires?
Yes, through the chair, Mr. Co-Chair, as long as we still have the two CL-215s on contract in state with BLM AFS. If for some reason, and there has been some discussion at the national level of reallocating those to Boise as their primary base, we've agreed with that, neither is AFS, but if that were to ever occur, then I think the state would have to examine whether it would benefit us to actually acquire at least a 90-day contract for that type of resource in state. But right now, we have the right mix of aviation resources for doing the job we need to do, in my opinion, with the exception of perhaps rotary aircraft. But that's another whole topic.
Chris, brief question. We've seen some federal pullback of funding. So can you speak briefly on what the status is of funding for the initial attack firefighting crews, either state or federal?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that is an issue. The state fire assistance comes through a consolidated grant through the state and private forestry. So a lot of our firefighting resources here in the state actually depend on a federal piece of funding. And our three advanced crews are Type 1 Hotshot Crew, Pioneer Peak, the White Mountain Type 2 IA crew, and then the Gannett Glacier Type 2, which IA stands for Initial Attack. They're highly trained crews, on par with the jumpers, at least at the Type 1 level, in terms of their capabilities and what they can do. Those crews have no state general fund money supporting the crews. They're all federal dollars, and that's a real issue for us as those federal dollars shrink. Over the last 10 years, state fire assistance nationally and to our state's gone down almost 19%. And we're expecting another fairly large hit in this next round, well, the budget that was just signed by Congress. So that is an issue. We've been able to keep the crews going by applying for and successfully competing for hazard fuel monies. I mentioned that $1 million that we acquired. When the crews are not actually fighting fire, we have them doing that hazard fuel mitigation work. So that helps cover some of their fixed costs, if you will, to have those kind of opportunities. So. That could be a significant challenge for us because that is 60 positions in Alaska of some highly trained individuals. And we always need those crews every fire season, and we always bring those type of crews from the lower 48 every fire season.
Thank you. I want to make sure and have the other divisions a chance to answer questions too. So thank you very much, Chris.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll ask Steve Matheson if he has any questions for GFS goal. Surveys. If you don't, I do. I'll ask my question then. As a neighbor with an interest in the Geological Materials Center, I'm glad to see you move to the old Sam's Club. I'm glad to see it's on track. What are the plans for that property on Fish Hatchery Road, the old GMT MC?
We are currently evaluating that at this time. We will have to dispose of that property. We are.
Hatchery? Really?
Well, it's Department of Natural Resources property, and I guess perhaps I should probably say we'll get back to you on that, Mr. Chairman. There are some issues there on that property that we have to investigate quite what to do with it before we decide whether to dispose of it or not. But if I can get back to you on that, that would probably be the best course of action.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Other question, Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the airborne geophysical data, that's always been sort of an ongoing program. Every year, a different square on the state is flown, and it has, over time, has resulted in a number of significant discoveries, or at least significant help select specific areas of interest for further exploration. In the coming year, what are your plans for continuing that program?
Through the chair, Mr. Co-Chair, we are currently evaluating areas that we would fly airborne geophysics in this current year, and that process is underway. We we go through kind of a review discussion to decide which is the best bang for our buck, essentially. And we'll be evaluating that in conjunction with our strategic and critical minerals project as well. So we'll see whether we can kind of kill two birds with one stone with the area that we select. And usually, shortly after this, we'll decide on an area and then start the process to procure the contractor.
Okay. And on another same slide, which is slide 8, the compilation of geothermal data for Alaska, was there anything notable that came up? I mean, we've had geothermal projects in the Alaska range, just downhill from Mount Spur. We've had a sort of a failed geophysical or geothermal project in NACNAC. I mean, I know in the Glen Allen area there's some interest in potential geothermal targets. Did the did this compilation of data indicate any new targets?
Through the chair, Mr. Co-Chair, not really. It's a compilation of existing information. Okay. So we didn't go out and collect any new data. It was just collecting all of the known sources of information from old publications and all the sources that we could find and kind of corral it together. Mm-hmm. And really that, what you're referring to, is probably the next step.
Any questions from Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the energy section here, collaborated with UAF and USGS on the shale potential on the North Slope. Could you talk about that a little bit more? And is that collaboration part of the shale task force? Is that still in existence and still meeting?
Through the chair, I'm not aware, Representative Tarr, of the shale task force, so I'm unfamiliar with that, so I don't know if it is or not. The work we are doing there is looking at the shale horizons that are the source rocks for the oil accumulations on the North Slope. And there are several different stratigraphic horizons that are of interest from tight oil perspective. So we will be going back out there this summer with the university and the USGS and collecting more samples for analyses, thermal maturity, hydrocarbon content, various parameters that would affect the ability to extract the oil from those rocks.
Thank you, President Feige. Last question.
On slide 9, under your volcanology section, I've always heard, at least over the last year, heard all about the funding woes from the USGS and the maintenance of the instruments that they have scattered up and down the Aleutian Chain and the Alaska Range. How much is their lack of funding is it impacting our ability to collect enough information to keep track of some of these some of these events, or is maintenance of those instruments becoming a concern? Obviously, with all the air traffic going from Anchorage to Asia, those routes are heavily impacted every time there's a major eruption. So it is in our best interest to maintain good information about what's going on out there.
Yes, through the chair, Mr. Co-Chair, our funding for the Alaskan Volcano Observatory, our portion of it has all been federal funding to date, and that has been declining over time. And with the federal budget situation, we're not quite sure, but I would imagine that we're not going to get a slug of money anytime soon. So that is impacting the network of monitoring sites on the volcanoes along the Alaska Peninsula and in the Aleutians. We have lost two volcanoes completely. Two of the networks are now dead and are not providing any information. And we have 8 of the remaining, I think there's 29 remaining sites. 8 of those are considered severely impaired in that they will provide some after-the-fact information but won't allow us to detect the seismicity that might, predate an eruption. And perhaps most critically is Pavlov Volcano, which is near some of the communities on the Alaska Peninsula, and it's one of the most active volcanoes out there. And in the last year or two, its eruptions have caused local flights to be diverted to avoid the ash cloud. So there is some life and health and safety issues, and the funding that we get from the federal government is inadequate to maintain all of those facilities. So, yeah, it is beginning to affect life and safety issues out there.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Seaton.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Backing up just for a moment to the shale investigation you're doing on the North Slope, is that in the existing lease at 500,000 or so acres of lease sale from those drilling activities, or are you actually doing drilling activities on other portions of that USGS identified source rock?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I'm not sure if our activities are on the actual lease sale itself or not. We study the geology, and our geology doesn't stop at lease sale boundaries, so we go where the rocks are sticking out of the ground so we can evaluate them. I would have to get back to you as to whether the area that we are working on the surface expression of these rock units is within the lease sale or not. But
okay, so you're working on surface expression, not on the actual lower potential.
That's correct. We do not have access to the most recent core that has been drilled on the North Slope. If we could, we would love to look at it.
Okay. Thank you. Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Masterson.
I'm going to
see if anyone has any questions on tap for the Mental Health Trust Lands Office Director. Representative Seaton has one.
Yeah.
Marcy, come back up.
Thanks. I didn't quite understand what diminished rate of exchange referred to.
Through the chair.
I thought you were talking about some land trades or something.
Right.
Diminished rates of exchange of was, I believe, what the statement was.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, perhaps I was speaking too quickly. The trust land exchange that we've endeavored to to push forward with the Tongass National Forest is relative to what I may call the diminished available timber in the trust portfolio. The trust land office manages what you might think of as buckets of resources, and in any type of investment portfolio or portfolio in which you're trying to maximize revenue, it's good to have a diversity of buckets. And one of those buckets is, of course, timber, and then there are the other buckets. And the effort of the land office has been to maintain that diverse categories of resources, one of course which is timber. And that bucket is running out of timber. And so what we have been accomplishing or attempting to accomplish is to get timber back into the bucket so we can continue to have a timber revenue source when perhaps maybe the price of gold goes down or, you know, other changes in commodities in the market occur. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, if I could just follow up. So this wasn't a differential amount of land trade or something, or I wasn't sure what rate of exchange meant.
Okay, and I apologize, Representative Seaton. I don't remember saying that, but if I could explain, the exchange, the fundamental premise of the exchange with the federal government is that it's an equal value exchange.
Okay.
So the lands that have been presented on the federal side will be appraised for their value, as will the trust lands, and then it'll be a value for a value exchange.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. That was
my other questions for Ms. Menefee? No, great, thank you.
Mr. Chair, can I make one comment, and that is I suddenly remembered that beneficiary group that is the most obvious of the four major groups, and that is Alaskans with mental illness.
Very good.
Thank you.
Thank you. Uh-huh. Lisa. Mr. Goodrum, any questions for the Director of Mining, Land, and Water? I'll kick us off, I guess. We've heard, Mr. Goodrum, we've heard a couple of years there have been the department working with the legislature has tried to address the permitting backlog, both with appropriations and more resources and in legislation. My question, I guess, would be there's currently some things that are in process. How important is it to the improvement of the permitting backlog that we do make progress on that current legislation?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The division and the department as a whole have been approaching it as an all-of-the-above approach, and so people, process, and legislative packages are all important as we try to make our system more efficient, as we work to modernize it, as we look to make it more transparent for our customers. And so the effort is very important, and there are a number of changes that still need to come, but we are aggressively pursuing those, and we have a lot of very dedicated people working on that process and working to make good legally defensible decisions for the use of state land and water. And so we continue to press forward on that, and it's something that we're not there yet, but it's a process of continuous improvement, and so we continue to move forward.
We've been impressed by the progress so far, and are looking forward to additional progress should you be able to fire on all cylinders. Representative Seaton?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There's been talking about permitting, and I've had a number of constituents ask me about what they perceive as inequity in, I guess it's probably, I'm not sure if land disposals, grazing leases, oil and gas leases, where in mariculture leases they're paying $450 per acre, and on grazing leases or on oil and gas lease lands they're paying $3 an acre. And the capital intensiveness of mariculture expenditures is higher in many cases than grazing leases or in agricultural leases. And I'm trying to figure out within the department, and this is probably a longer topic than we can have right now, but if we want to stimulate economic growth in our communities, if we have something that's quite burdensome as far as a lease rental on mariculture leases, it's becoming a drag, and so I would like at some point in time, and if you're not the right person, we can get to them later, but trying to figure out a balance for getting economic development on in our coastal communities.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I think that's a great idea, and we would we'd look forward to working with you on that and bringing the right people into the room to figure out how we do that.
Okay. Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Goodham, on the permit backlog, you mentioned that it decreased 53.5% since the beginning of FY12. What's that number of backlog permits down to, just ballpark, because I know it's going down every minute. So.
Through the chair, Co-Chair Feige, we started it in fiscal year 2012 with a number of 2,658 authorizations in backlog. As of 31 December, we were at 1,237 authorizations that are still out there for us to adjudicate in backlog. So it is still a decent number out there, a sizable number we still need to address, but we are working and moving in that direction. So 1,237 is the number as of 31 December.
Okay. Other questions for Mining, Land, and Water? No, we're going to gallop through the last couple divisions in the time we have, so if I could ask Mr. Barron, come back up and see if there's questions for the director of the Division of Oil and Gas. Maybe not. Ladies first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the page 12 here, we're 90 leases awarded in North Slope, all within 7 weeks of sale date. You had said that it used to take 8 to 12 months. Was that something internal realignment that led to the expediency in processing those, or was it related to legislation or both?
Through the chair, great question, Representative Parr. Basically, it was internal. Okay. And the team kind of just asked themselves, what are we doing and why are we doing it? Mm-hmm. And one of the critical aspects that we found out was we had a history of holding all the leases until all of them were ready to be adjudicated. Mm-hmm. And we decided that we weren't going to do that anymore. And as packages, as bundles were done, we began to process those very quickly. Okay. So if there is an outstanding one, a problem child, shall we say, that needed extra surveying or extra research, that didn't hold up the rest of them.
Thank you.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 129, that division got through last time, was working on expediting things, and it did. However, I'm getting a number of comments from people, especially in the Ninilchik and up area, that now there are things that are happening very quickly, developers are wanting five acres, and they put up a rig, and there's gas drilling, either right alongside the road or right next to their properties in these places that are not large swaths of state land. They're all broken up into private land. Is there, has the division been handling any questions on those, and is there any public notice of those kind of activities, or are they just under automatic acquire 5 acres and put up a drilling rig and start tomorrow?
Through the chair, Representative Seen, I think the ones that you're referring to are on either private, federal, or native land, and that is not not within my overview position. And point in fact, we have not propagated any regulations relative to the 129. We're still in the public comment period and reviewing the comments and fact-checking how the process that we described at the last session and how we've described it to the public, how those regs that we have internal, right, they're just for internal review, how the public comments are fitting in with how we're proposing to do that. So we have not actioned any efforts associated with 129 at this time.
Great. Thank you.
Director, regarding the incentives the state offers both for on tax rates and on the jack-up drilling rigs in Cook Inlet oil and gas exploration, any new information that might be illuminative for the committee members to know about what's happening in Cook Inlet?
Mr. Chair, the Cook Inlet, especially the offshore activities, were very robust this past drilling season in the summer. Fury continued to do some of their delineation work in Kitchen Fury. Lights. Fury, that's correct. The previous name you might remember was Escapada. They had a management change and some funding opportunities come their way, and have really changed the course of a lot of their business and are a very good player in the inlet. We're glad to have them. Buccaneer and their primary working interest owner, Bluecrest, continue to do activities at the Cosmopolitan lease and had some gas work there, and they are going to progress those activities not only offshore but onshore, with onshore being the target for oil plays because it's deeper, and gas facilities offshore. Continuing on with offshore activities, Fury is now in the construction phase of a small caisson-type platform. I can give you some pictures at a later date. It will be the first kind of its evolution in the inlet as far as platforms, and we've been very focused on making sure that the design and installation process is following the correct engineering parameters as would be required for this kind of habitat in the environmental area. So the inlet continues to be quite robust in its activities. Kenai Loop is still an aggressive play by Buccaneer. Buccaneer recently spud in Representative Seaton's backyard at West Eagle. Hillcorp continues to do some very good work in terms of oil production and escalated work in the gas phase. In fact, very soon after Hillcorp took over the properties of Marathon and Chevron and sat down with the utilities, the gas default issue was rather quickly solved, and we've now got secured contracts through 2018. Cook Inlet Energy continues to progress some of their activities and, in fact, are now progressing a purchase of some of the Armstrong properties down in South Kenai. So the prospects are still very good and still very active in the inlet.
I know that in my district and around South Central Alaska, there are concerns about the future supply of locally generated gas. And so if you were to characterize it cautiously optimistic, really optimistic, neutral, what are the prospects after 2018, given the level of activity we've seen so far?
Well, I would put it as very positive. Mr. Chairman, the production that will be coming from the Fury platform and the potential of the production coming from the Cosmopolitan structures will be coming online arguably sometime between 2015 and 2017, which will dovetail nicely with any issues that might come up in the contractual basis in 18.
Glad to hear. Other questions? Representative Tarr?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Back to page 3 and just the overall department accomplishments. Signed MOU with Resources Energy to focus effort on a Cook Inlet LNG export project. So in the context of the comments you were just making to Rep. Sadler's question, can you comment on how that fits into that future, you know, efforts, future projects?
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, if your question is how does REI fit within the framework, I really don't have a clear answer for you. If the question is how does LNG as a market play into the Cook Inlet? It is a piece. It's a piece whether it's from supplying gas to Conoco for export or whether it's a piece playing into potential deliveries to local markets and possibly trucking to Fairbanks, which has been going on for many, many years. Mm-hmm. Again, the real issue with Cook Inlet gas has always been a supply and demand issue. And when you have more supply, the companies need to find more demand. Mm-hmm. And if they don't find the demand, then their opportunities to capitalize their money goes elsewhere. Mm-hmm. So the more gas that we have available, the increased market can be driven. Agrim has been in talking to the division. ConocoPhillips is continuing to think about and get their license renewed. There's Donlin Creek. Mm-hmm. There's the gas storage project. So all of these begin to play into a broader mix of supply and demand matrix.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We have like very few minutes. I want to make sure that if there are questions for the directors of Parks or of OPUMP, that we can get those questions answered. Because I'm pretty sure, Bill, you're going to be back in front of us. I don't know if Ben and Tom will. Are there other questions for the other division directors?
for Ellis.
Okay. With your indulgence, Ben, could you pop up and we'll take care of that? And you don't get down nearly enough, so. Representative Feige's got a question. We have an extra inning, so go ahead, Representative Feige.
Okay, thanks. Director, welcome back to Juneau.
Thanks.
The issues I have are just a couple of district issues. Received a number of complaints regarding the management of snow machine access in the Hatcher Pass area. It seems to some of my constituents that one class of user in that recreation sort of complex of different types of areas are being favored and the snow machiners are being somewhat restricted. I don't know if maybe that's something you need to go back and look at. So I'll let you get back to me on that one.
To the chair, Representative Feige, I look forward to that. There is, we started a new management plan last year for access. So I can give you a much more detailed answer through communications.
Okay. And then there's two. The other issue is the Worthington Glacier at which is right about Thompson Pass area on the Richardson Highway. That particular area seems to, I don't even know if they opened it last year. It's basically just an observation area, kind of a parking area off the highway. There's people, I guess, willing to volunteer in the area, and they're being told that there's no funds to open it. That at Thompson Pass and Richardson Highway and the whole Valdez end of things, they do get a significant amount of tourists traffic through there, and the Worthington Glacier is, you know, one of the few areas in the state where you basically get a roadside look at an actual Alaska glacier. So, sort of appreciate, you know, see what we can do to make sure that is reopened and some of the funding and management emphasis is headed in that direction. And then finally, the last one is outhouses along the road. Certainly in the summertime, a lot of those are open, but in the wintertime, a lot of them are shut down. It doesn't have any plumbing. I'm not sure why we need to lock the doors. Yes, I'm sure there's kind of a snow clearing aspect, but you know, as long as the road into it is plowed and somebody can at least open the door on the thing, they should be able to use it if they need to use it. One particular area is the Paxson area. In December, the Paxson Lodge closed, so now you don't have that sort of, you know, mid-trip rest stop between Delta and Glen Allen. And there's really not much else on that stretch of road. Folks are very interested about, you know, making sure that, you know, at least something is available so they don't have to go find the nearest snowbank.
Mr. Chair, Representative Feige, on that last comment, as you well know, some may be waysides that are supervised or under the direction of the Department of Transportation. We're looking right now at a map of what is available, whether it's DOT, parks, wherever, to be able to address that issue. And I look forward to talking to you more about that.
Okay, and you want to, I guess, in the overall management of outhouses in Alaska, I mean, it's kind of scattered. I mean, you got some that are DOT, some that are parks, and I already beat on the DOT guys yesterday. But whatever you can work out to make the logistical management of those the most efficient, I think would certainly benefit not only our folks, but the folks who come to visit Alaska every year.
Absolutely.
Thanks.
Along those lines, briefly, you've made an effort to address some deferred maintenance backlog with your facilities around the state. How's that going for you?
Mr. Chairman, we have approximately $60 million worth of deferred maintenance within Alaska State Parks. We've, over the last number of, 3 or 4 years, we've noticed that funding of around $3 million a year toward deferred maintenance keeps us right about even. Yeah. And that is about the level that we've been receiving over the last year, so our last 2 or 3 years. So we sort of stay current with what we have. We hit the biggest ones. We just, twice a year, Mr. Chairman, we evaluate our deferred maintenance and evaluate the priorities of that. And unfortunately, it stays still about $60 million at a $3 million a year deferred maintenance focus.
Thank you very much, man. Representative Seaton, did you have more questions for, do you want to bring up Bill Barron again?
I did have a question, and it might be for the commissioner, actually, and that was, if I can.
Just for the record, we're under the indulgence of the chair of the following Labor and Commerce Committee. We have a little extra inning, but only a couple more minutes.
Thank you. And I was concerned, I wanted to find out, you know, when we, as a legislature, passed a resolution supporting the extension of the ConocoPhillips export license last time, we had in there a whereas that relating to the rack availability to get LNG for Alaskans, and I was wanting to find out if the department is making sure that no matter what goes forward, whether that's ConocoPhillips or REI or anything, that if we're doing LNG, that we can have some assurance that for Alaskans there'll be rack availability, commercially reasonable terms of LNG.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I'd be happy to get you a copy of the letter that I sent to ConocoPhillips asking them to develop an application for additional export volumes from that facility. Included in that letter was mention of a truck rack.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Good deal. Thank you. And with that, I want to thank Commissioner Balash and his division directors and his strangely silent deputy commissioners. We will be hearing again next Monday from Commissioner Balash to talk about the heads of agreement document for the proposed LNG project. And with that, we will adjourn at 3:07 p.m. Thanks.